monk. You know, they're supposed to be all, you know, just, I mean, they are almost God. I mean, that, I shouldn't say almost God, but I mean, yeah, they are really representative. And I hear he's kind of really kind of cool. I think, yeah, my respect for him would have gone down.
Why? Let's elaborate that.
Okay. I don't know if I really respect homosexuality. Maybe that's it. I'm not sure.
Let's say that Narcissus was there, and suddenly you got a little chapter of the book and found out that he ran away and frolicked with a milkmaid and came back. Did you also lose respect for him?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's the issue, is that sometimes the flag of homosexuality is raised as if it's some big bugaboo, and that's really not the issue. The issue is sexuality in general, and that's another way of approaching the what we're talking about here, and religion as well, but there's a lot of stuff going on there that we kind of get confused about. Not that homosexuality isn't something to be talked about, too. What is that? What is it about sexuality itself that suddenly makes you less your hero that goes out and has sex is someone who you can't talk about? You have a great teacher who is sitting there in school and is spouting all this great wisdom, and then you find out that he's having this series of affairs, and suddenly everything he says is not relevant anymore. I saw a lot of hands go up. I don't know which one went first.
I have a feeling I think it has a lot to do with the way society is today and the way it has perverted sex and everything else.
You want to elaborate on that a bit? Tom and Brent, and there's some right
here. The issue is for me that he was a monk, he'd taken vows. In his mind first, and then here, this deals the same thing with Goldman about, they talked about those things. Well, Narcissus had taken those vows. He was supposedly super monk.
Super monk.
He was, and that would just be like, you know, Superman walking, if you saw one of the Superman movies and Superman walked down the street and hit some little boy for no reason and knocked him into a brick wall, then, hey, you lose all your respect for Superman, don't you?
I want to add one thing about that before we get to Brent, is that if you saw the last Superman film, Superman loses his power when he actually falls in sexual love with Lois Lane. What kind of message is that telling us? I mean, I think we're seeing a couple of interesting things.
I don't know. I guess I think what Christine was saying was interpreted wrong by you, Lori. That's how I feel. Because she said that if Narcissus had a homosexual relationship or a sexual relationship, whatever, she'd lose some respect for him. I don't think she'd say she'd lose all respect for him. I know that I wouldn't. I think the only area I would lose respect for him would be in his choice of sexuality. Myself. So I agree with Christine because I've talked with her about this before. But I wouldn't negate everything else in his life just because he chose his expression of sexuality.
Wow! I don't think Brent's done yet. You said that you would lose respect for him in his choice of sexuality. The implication is that if he chose a heterosexual expression, then that would be okay to you, but a homosexual expression would not be okay. Is that what you said?
No, I think he took vows, and as a monk, he took vows for his religion, is his basic values that he's accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I think if he took vows, at one time it must have been very important to him, and if he went against that later on, and whether it was homosexual or heterosexual or a cat or whatever, I think he would be going against his basic values of his religious beliefs.
I see. Getting back to Tom's original idea of sin, then, that he would be sinning simply because he was off his own mark.
Yeah, I think so.
I see. Okay.
I don't know if this is appropriate at this time, but maybe it might be a good exercise, maybe a little closer to home. And here you're putting this monk on this pedestal, and our pastors take a vow. Mm-hmm. And what would happen if your pastor left his wife and the church and ran off with a woman in his congregation?
That happens to pastors all the time, actually.
Quite a high percentage, actually.
Yes. Christine, you seem to be animated.
Well, you said, you know, I am. Because, I mean, I don't want to lose the point. You said, you know, why would we be so upset? And the reason I would be so upset is because you just said they are in this figurehead there. I kind of like place them on a pedestal. And when I feel that they're having all these, you know, they go out and maybe run around with women, or they have, it makes them more human to me. And I don't.
So it's your expectation.
Yeah, it's my expectations of them. And so it's kind of like, they're just like me, you know, come on.
And I'm so worthless anyway that.
Do
you feel differently, like if it were, let's say, your mom, your dad, your prof, compared to a monk?
What about Martin Luther King?
Is there something about religion?
Hey, he said, you know, the Greek has something to do.
But how many people, if they realized how many affairs he had outside of his marriage, would think that he was really such a great guy? What about Jack Kennedy, who has a reputation for having amazing amounts of extramarital relationships? Would he then still, what about, how would you feel about him? I'm just thinking that it's real interesting what you said. In fact, it's a fundamental importance of what we do to heroes and how we deny our own power in the process of giving it all to heroes. And then as soon as the hero does something that's a little bit weird, we not only destroy them.
No, it's weird.
Weird, yes. Whatever we think weird is. Because it's like we invest them with the thing that we can't empower ourselves.
Yeah, I see that. I like the way you said that. No, I don't think I invest. If I have a hero or I really respect somebody, and maybe they have things I don't have, but I don't really feel subservient to them. I don't think that's the right word to use.
Don't put them on a pedestal.
Oh, some people I respect, but I don't know if they're way up on a pedestal. But you know, if I respect somebody and then, you know, I find out they're just like me in a lot of areas that I really thought that they weren't, my expectations going back to that, then that makes me, you know, kind of blows my ideal of them. And therefore, maybe lose respect as a good word.
Well, I think that what I'm saying is that it all comes down to with how we image ourselves.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Where do we get our expectations from? Are they from our morality projecting on other people? Is that what?
I don't know, what do you think, Guy?
That's what it looks like to me.
Huh?
I don't know, I may be wrong, but it seems like we're getting off base because we got to consider in the context of the book and the character that Narcissus was. Michelle mentioned last night how many times they used the words piety and pious, and especially referring to Narcissus. That was such a big part of the character, such a big part of that masculine, analytical character was that he, you know, spent all this time fasting, praying, you know, having prayer vigils and all that stuff, that it was such a big part of that, the total person, about him being a monk and him, his morality, that if he had some other, you know, if they did have some sexual escapade with him, that would have really detracted from that and just, to me, negated so much of what Hesse was trying to create in that character. And that's just what I see in the book. And it seems to me that if we're talking about pastors and stuff, we're not talking about Narcissus, because now we're starting to talk, everybody has some of Narcissus and some of Goldman in them. And it seems like we're talking about a completely different thing.
Tom, are you saying the contradictions within ourselves?
No, I'm saying if it's the Narcissus in us that is doing something that is against our morality, then our morality is different. I mean, it seems to me that the Narcissus part of us can't do something against our religion because that's what contains the laws of it almost. It's like, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but it seems like
So you're saying they're not in conflict? That you sort of readjust the morality, or that the morality can handle it?
Well, there has to be negotiations between Narcissus and Goldman about that. But it just seems like Narcissus is the part of us that keeps, maybe I'm getting into Freudian terms, but the Narcissus is the one that keeps our morality, that, I'm not exactly sure, but all I know is Narcissus couldn't have, not in this book, he couldn't have, to me, he couldn't have done anything.
Have you finished the book? Gotten to the end of the book yet?
Not yet. Probably does something at the end of the book. Great.
Well, there's just something really important at the end of the book that sort of talks about what... Remember we talked to Russell Baker, we asked what did he give up in order to grow up? What happened to him? And I think one of the things that Hess points out is what we who follow a line more like Narcissus give up to do that, or what we who follow a line more like Goldman give up. What is the nature of the surrender, which I think is pertinent to what you're saying, but I won't... I don't want to comment on it until you've read through. There were a couple other hands up, though.
I will say, I should have spoke up sooner because I'm raising my hand and it's going to pass. But anyway, I just want to say that, you know, Tom was talking about the narcissist part of us, and that's being that, you know, the straight religious, we're going to follow all this. But I see myself as that, too. I mean, but I goof sometimes. And I mean, this whole idea of the pastors and we put everybody on a pedestal. Yeah, they have a responsibility. And, you know, they're supposed to set the example that their congregations or they're the people in the monastery, the people that are just learning or something to follow. But they are human, and we can look at them human. We can look at them, though, that maybe they're a little stronger in that. But you got to give them a break, I mean, in a sense. I mean, I know you still got to keep that look up to them, but don't worry about the stick.
I guess I'd like to share something. About 5 years ago, I started getting involved with the church again. And my pastor, he's about 50 years old. 5 years ago, he's 50 years old. Anyway, he was the one that kind of took me by the hand and helped me to delve into myself and make religion part of me, or make, you know, help me with my problems. I had lots of questions. I'd spend hours with him talking about Christianity and things. And so I really respect him and love him a lot. And last summer, his wife died. Eugene. And it's a big church, big conservative church, Lutheran church. And, he's only been there for like 7 years. And there's a lot of people still aren't sure they like him. And so he's been struggling a lot with the congregation and things. Anyway, his wife died. And for the next couple months, his mind was just frazzled. I mean, he'd get up in the pulpit and he wouldn't be able to talk. He just, you know, he just, without his wife, he just didn't have the companionship. And obviously he didn't have, wasn't able to engage in sex. Because his wife died, he was still mourning her a few months after that. And I knew his sexual values, and, you know, pretty much based on scripture, and took scripture for is what he accepted in his life. And so it was hard for him because he'd gone all these years with a wife, and now all of a sudden he didn't have her. And he's really struggling with it, and he has a girlfriend now. And the thing is that he's trying to keep it under wraps and things because. And there's rumors going around the church already, you know, that, you know, they're seeing each other and things. And it's like, it's really a bad bad situation in the sense that he can't just come out and say, you know, this is the way it is. He can't just make it public because he knows he's in that leadership position. He knows there will be people that will lose respect for him if all of a sudden he says, yeah, 2 months after my wife died, you know, I started going out with a girl. And, thing is, he sees nothing wrong with it. His daughters are having problems with it because they say, oh, you know, your mom, you know, it's only been 2 months and now, you know, he's thinking about marriage already and all these other things. And the thing that they don't understand, I guess, is that he's a human being also. He has basic drives and needs. And he is in a leadership position, but he's also human. And it's that paradox in a way. And he knows that if he plans to marry this lady, he's not going to probably stay around in that church very long. He'll probably plan on moving on a lot. That's just the way it is. He sees it. He's very intellectual with why it's man. He sees it for what it is, good or bad.
I think Brent's bringing up some really important issues that are directly related to narcissism and Goldman.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And I think one of them has to do with something that Hermann Hesse tries to do in the book, which is one of the most provocative parts of the book. And that is, we all know that there is a public morality and a personal morality. There's the morality that preachers and parents give us, and then there's the reality of what happens in everyday life. That morality sometimes can fit into a structure you can understand, and sometimes it shocks you when you find out the truth. But we see it every day in our personal relationships. Sometimes you call it the double standard. You react one way to women than you do to men. Sometimes it's called racism. It can be called whatever you want to call it. But basically what happens then is that there's a part of us that is always dishonest, a part of us that is always trying to hide, always trying to keep something away from children, keep something away from my wife, keep something away from somebody. And what happens then is that what do we feel about the moral structure that we have inherited? Well, if I can just continue pontificating for a moment or two, what happens is our moral structure becomes skeptical, like Russell Baker does. Russell Baker realizes that there are a lot of hidden rules going on. Several of you have talked about hidden rules, things that you can't talk about, things that you can't confront your friends about, things that when you feel angry you can't talk about, issues that you can't raise in public, issues that are of fundamental importance. What does that mean when your public morality and your private morality do not measure up? What is that saying about the good of the system, the good of the structure of morality? I think that that's a real important issue. What Hess does when he talks about that is he raises it up in such a way that it is right in front of our eyes all the time. And what is that about? How does that affect our lives? What Jungian psychology was about, and it was the idea that we need to address these issues, not because we want to destroy one system and set it up with another system, but to look at what that system is about. Why is it that one side says one thing, the other side of us says the other thing, and they don't measure up? How can you get them to love each other? And what is the process that you have to do? Is it a compromise where nobody wins? Is it an integration that somehow changes your vision of what the morality is? What is that all about? Having said that, I think it'd be really interesting to kind of talk about that a little bit. We've all experienced what Brent's talking about in bigger or smaller ways, whether it's affecting our own personal relationships, our families, our churches, whatever. How do we feel about that inconsistency? We know it's around all the time. Mostly we ignore it.
End up sacrificing one or the other. You either sacrifice your own morality so that you aren't out of touch with the other one, or else you sacrifice, and by that you sacrifice part of yourself. Or you sacrifice the public morality and face a lot of hard knocks, maybe or leers or something.
Are those the only two choices?
No, there's always a third choice.
What's the third choice in this case?
The third choice is to find a...
What do you think Jesus or Gandhi would do?
He would go with their public, their personal morality, what they felt was right for them and what God was right for them. And the imposition of a public morality doesn't really help anybody. It can keep a lot of things down. It can keep a lot of good people from helping things out.
Tom and then Brent. You want Brent first, Tom?
It doesn't matter.
Brent.
I just wanted to, I think it is important, though, to have kind of public morality, I guess. In a way, it's good and bad. I guess the reason I see it as good is because basically it's there, whether you say it's, whether you don't like it, it's kind of like war, it's there.
But that doesn't make it good.
OK, okay, but okay, what I meant, okay, the reason I think it's good is the sense that the person is a role model, usually. And for somebody like Gandhi or Jesus or most, you know, pastors, their lifestyle is in itself a role model as well, because religion is a lifestyle. And I think that if, like when I was watching the film Gandhi, if I saw him having all kinds of extramarital affairs and things, I think that his life as a role model for me, and for quite a few people, I think, would have gone down.
But I think part of what this comes back to is the having rules of your religion. I mean, if that was Gandhi's personal faith, and he felt right with it, then he's not a role model, so don't follow his role. Make up your own. Use your own personal morality is your own role. Be your own role model.
Tom, Kai's having an emergency situation here. Do you want to relinquish your turn at the floor to him, or do you want to talk?
Well, I have something directly related, but go ahead.
Make it quick, Kai.
I just want to say, do you live to be a role model, or do you live to be yourself?
But what if being yourself is being a role model in a way? What if you just
have then that's okay. Fine. That's what these people are. But they're not a role model because they're not living to be a role model. So, hey, if I'm going to do this so these people see it that way, they be themselves, and that's why they become a role model.
You brought
the
subject of Gandhi and Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And private morality and public morality. Well, okay, here's public morality. If your private morality is higher than the public morality, and you follow that, then you're a hero, like Jesus or Gandhi. If your personal morality is below the public morality, and you follow that, then you're a slut or a whore or something like that.
Female terms. Could you please include female terms?
I don't know where the male terms for it. I mean, scoundrel.
No.
Gigolo.
Christine, did you want to say something?
I think it was Jesus.
Well, Christine had her hand up before.
I just was going to say that the public and private thing is kind of something that it's hard to have just one morality when from your parents they tell you one thing and they never tell you about what their personal what it's like for them. But like I know this from when my boyfriend and I went to talk to the pastor and he said, well, I have to tell you now that I'm going to advise you to do something totally different than what I would tell my daughter to do. So I think that, you know, it's kind of a learned thing. It's not something that you can really avoid. You're brought up in that.
But you can also teach yourself to not do it if you think that's it's valid.
I mean, if you're raised in Cambodia and you have Cambodian morality, you're not going to survive in the United States.
Well, that's
with the United States morality.
That's not exactly what I'm talking about. That's really a very different kind of issue, Kate. I think what I want to talk about is something that's a little more insidious than that. Lisa, you have your hand up.
I just wanted to know, I mean, you were getting a little excited there by me, and I wanted to know what you had to say, but, you're one of the great
persons.
Well, I mean, I'll take a risk and say what I had to say about it. I mean, I think the idea of having a public morality and a private morality is bullshit. And the reason I think it is that what it does is it denies, it disempowers us. Here we are as people going through the world. We are people with needs, urges, beliefs. We have things about us that we're constantly told are wrong, things about us that we're supposed to believe that we think are right, and we struggle with that left and right all the time. Several of us have talked about that kind of struggle. To me, the best model I can have is a model that I can address myself to. I love Martin Luther King because he was a sexual being. He was a person who had his faults, who talked about his faults publicly, and who addressed them in such a way that I could say, hey, I could have something to say too. I could participate in this world. I don't have to worry about flagellating myself against the moral system to try and make myself be something I am not. I can be always get striving to be better at it. So my heroes are never heroes that are perfect. And I oftentimes feel that when we try and accept a double standard in our lives or in anybody else's lives, all we're doing is we're asking ourselves to the bleed at our own in our own personal dichotomies. We stew in our own juices that lack the capacity to integrate ourselves, that keep us from being able to respond to the world in a cohesive and divine kind of way. Frankly, I think that if more ministers and priests would accept their own sexuality as part of it, political point of view is another part of it, have relationships with people that are more holistic, and we realize that what they are is human beings struggling with living a divine law here on earth, then I think we can all wind up realizing that we too can do that as well. Too often times I see people telling me what to do and how to do it, and I know inside of myself that's not right for me. And what are you going to do with that? It means that, oh, I must be sick, I must be a sinner, I must be wrong, I must be incapable of making my own decisions. I am disempowered from being able to experience that same kind of inner divinity, or inner power, however you want to talk about it. And so I think that all of us struggle with that issue, and unfortunately we never have the courage to be able to identify it, whether it's in our own personal relationships, being able to say, oh, okay, I want something from this person, so I'm going to say this thing, whether it's in our the greater community that we are, there's the issue going on that I'm really not interested in addressing because it's going to be a little bit uncomfortable, whether it's in a political situation or whether it's in a spiritual situation. That the more we fail to integrate the discrepancies that are there, the more we fail to address them and try and make friends with them, the less we're going to know about who we really are and what the truth, our personal truth, really is. That's the way I feel about it. I think the minister would give more to his congregation if he were public about the fact that he has this relationship and let them struggle with the problem. Because if they can't handle it, they need to sort of feel the struggle to realize that the issue is there than to hide it, to try and put it under the carpet and pretend that it doesn't exist.
A little bit about personal truth, and I think that we do need people that we can look up to and respect.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, I mean, the feeling I got from you was that you said something about heroes and about how you said that they are perfect. I mean, and inhuman. I've never, made a person imperfect inhuman. I mean, you always have to keep in mind that they are human and that they're fallible.
Don't you do that to yourself, Christine? Don't you have an idea of who it is that you want to be and what you strive to be and how you strive to make yourself fit into that passionate place? Don't you feel how the inconsistencies of your own life kind of measure up in a kind of way that it's hard to resolve?
I don't get the point.
The point is, I think, is that all of us have this idea that who we are isn't right and that what we have to do is make it righter. And I think part of our heroes, and I see your hand up there, Tom, and part of the reason we develop heroes is a way of fostering that idea that if I'm not right, at least someone else is right, and that's okay. What I'm trying to say is that if we can make ourselves right, we can always make ourselves better, but if we're right, if we're perfect at being who we are at that moment, and we have models that help us do that, then I think we can experience the world and grow with the world as opposed to having the sort of battles and hatreds that we have. When you hate somebody, when somebody hates you, when you fear somebody and somebody fears you, you're basically fearing the fact that you are not very good. And you manifest that fear by making yourself feel better than somebody else oftentimes. And instead of heroes, we need models. And for me, personally,
I see
models are human, models have frailties, models have sexual organs, models learn things, models make mistakes, etc., etc.
Okay, but you do feel that you'll get to this place where... you're happy
I'm already happy now, basically because I've accepted that part of me that isn't exactly what I thought it was.
Okay, and then grow with the world.
Yeah, to make myself better is part of growth. I mean, growth is something you start out as a little seedling and you become a tree.
Okay.
But the growth is really healthy if you look inside yourself and looked at the conflicts and look through the fears, and that's what this class is all about, basically, is freeing you up to choose.
And one last thing, Tom. I get really angry when I hear about people who are supposedly the people we look up to, our spiritual advisors, our high school counselors, our therapists, our priests, whatever they are, who won't tell me the truth. Who won't tell me that they have these feelings, who won't tell me that they've had homosexual relationships, who won't express themselves as being who they are. How am I supposed to handle the world and all of its complexities if no one tells me the code? We grow up in a system that is constantly denying us information, denying us information about ourselves, denying us information about our neighbors, denying us information about our parents. I didn't know my father was married before he died, and I found out that he was. I mean, that's the kind of system that there is. And I resent that, because what that does is it disempowers me, it makes me deny those parts of myself, it makes me fail to be able to realize that I am a whole manifestation in my own right of what humanity is about, as we all are. And I have a great deal of anger about that very issue. And to constantly be creating more role models that just do the same damn thing generation after generation is repeating the problems that we have now. We talk about war, we talk about starvation, we talk about injustice. This is where I think it comes from, partly anyway. This is, or at least it's another lower level manifestation of it, and I'm talking too much. Tom, you've had your hand up for a while.
Then real heroes don't really care whether they're called a hero or a sleaze, because to them the standard disappears, the public morality standard disappears. So it just depends on other people. If society calls them, you know, a sleaze, then they're going to do it. I mean, just like Jesus, I'm not talking in sexual ways, but Jesus was immoral according to the Jews. I mean, he did all kinds of things on the Sabbath, and he went to the houses of Gentiles and went to places, you know, went to Levi's place where they were having a wild party of tax collectors and sat there and had a few mugs of wine with them. I mean, you know, Jews were standing back saying, you know, this is terrible. But Jesus was willing to be called, I don't think Jews use the term sleaze.
Whatever the Hebrew equivalent of sleaze is.
Yes. And he was willing to take on that. And that's what made him a hero, not his level of morality, because I don't think Jesus had a separation between public and private morality.
Let me extend that even a little further. It's easier for me to talk about St. Francis, because if there's a personal hero of mine, it's St. Francis. I'm sure you all know who St. Francis is. Is there anyone who doesn't know who St. Francis is? St. Francis is this this guy who came from a fairly upper middle class background, I guess you'd say now, whose father was a rich merchant, and he decided that in order to be Christian, what he had to do was throw away everything, all his clothes, in fact, and to sort of go out there and just live with nature. He was a person who responded to the natural world. And at that particular time, the church, as it was real threatened by it, because what that allowed people to do is to have a personal relationship with God. You didn't have to go through a priest, you didn't have to go to a cathedral, you didn't have to pay penance, you didn't have to donate money, you didn't have to do any of that stuff. A real threat. What happened finally, several hundred years later, is everyone thought, yeah, right, St. Francis was a cool guy, they made him into a hero, they built cathedral after cathedral in his name, they painted all these pretty pictures, and I'm sure St. Francis right now is sort of having a good laugh at how he was so misinterpreted by people, because he was made into a hero. And I think in some ways, that's a mythology, that when we create heroes, we are supporting a particular kind of need, a need that is an important thing to look at, especially in its inconsistencies. And when I look at what we do with Martin Luther King, I think we do the same thing with him. And we constantly make people into being what we want them to be, not what they really are. And I think probably that's true of Christ. I think it's, like I say, it's true of St. Francis. I think it's less true of Gandhi at the moment, but I think that there are other things about Gandhi's life that we don't want to know, so we deny. You won't read about him very much in most autobiographies. And so that's the kind of thing that I think we need to think about. Deal with in break time.
This is kind of, I was looking at the syllabus over there and said a couple things that I want to talk about. And one of them was about self and fame. For me, that's a real struggle, too. And
self and what?
Fame.
Fame.
Fame. Like
fame.
He's going to live forever.
But anyway, for a transition, maybe, get into it, I guess. Maybe like, I was thinking, like, we're talking about pedestals and putting people up, you know, and public morality and stuff like that. And something hit me that, like, for, like, a president of the United States, we have a different, put them on a different kind of pedestal than we would put, let's say, a favorite rock group. You know, like, if we were a favorite rock group, you know, we're having parties and drugs and sex and everything, we'd go, yeah, that's what we expect of them, you know. And the president, we heard, and the president, you know, he has a wife, and he lives, and they have guests, and everything's, you know, where he wears 4-piece suits, you know, whatever.
4-piece suits. I love it.
Yeah. And what if we had switched those and found out, like, the president was involved in drugs and, you know, and sex parties and everything, and then the rock stars had a wife, lived in a house, and had China, you know, and whatever. Anyway, it's kind of weird, but
Prince doesn't.
I guess, I don't know.
Prince doesn't do drugs.
I guess I'm just rambling on in my mind about these new things.
Well, I think that's a really good point in terms of, that's an issue that a lot of us have, and I think that in a way that relates directly to the conversation we had before, or the lecture I was giving before break, which was about self-empowerment. And fame is one of the ways we empower ourselves. It's like we're gonna let a rock group be as rambunctious, if you will, or raunchy, if you wanna stay with our words, as anyone, but we don't allow that to ourselves. We are not empowered to do that, but somehow a rock group is empowered to do that. Sort of an interesting kind of point. And to relate this to Narcissus and Goldman, Goldman could have been famous. He knew he could have been famous. And he chose not to be. He thought about it real hard. He went through a lot of consternation about that. And he didn't. Why? Let's talk about Goldman for a minute before we get back to the issue in general. Why did he not want fame? Let's be a little more elaborate. It obviously wasn't for him, but why? He could have had a wife, he could have had a place, he could have had a workshop, he could have had assistants, he could have had commissions. Laura?
Because he saw that his master, that guy, that artist guy, Nicholas?
Nicholas, yeah.
Nicholas, right. That after he got all his fame and all the money and stuff, that his passion died down. It wasn't the same.
And they didn't give him the freedom. A lot of his quotes said he didn't have the freedom to experience the season and feel what it's like to be in there.
Okay, go ahead, Lisa.
I thought that he saw his master as once he became famous, he was living for other people in terms of how he lived his life. He was creating art for other people. He was whatever they demanded. He was sort of at their beck and call. And so, in that sense, he wasn't living a passionate life for himself. And I think that is what Goldman valued most, to be doing that for himself, no matter what he did. And so I think that that's my point.
Just to add to that, it said that his art was him, it was his soul. It came out of his soul, and it was everything he created. When he started creating things from other people, even when he said that Nicholas had made him like
what does this have to do with the idea of self-empowerment? Where did Nicholas get his strength?
From other people, their approval.
Okay, and where did Goldman get his strength?
From himself.
So what does the issue of fame have to do with this?
You get fame from other people. You get fame from other people, and by getting that from other people, you lose your own control. And by empowering yourself, you're denying others the right to be. Or maybe not.
I was thinking more, if you're empowering yourself, your power is stronger. You don't have to rely upon the other people who may or may not be there.
That power you can get the hand not necessarily that thing that comes to them. You have to know can let other people see.
Can you relate to Pope to that? I mean, I don't think the Pope can spoke to become famous. I mean, he's different from a rock or something, because I don't think he gets popular.
No, I don't think we should. I think that we should keep that in mind.
Because that's a different type of.
Add it to one of the little balls we're juggling here. Did I see a hand up somewhere?
Todd was going to say something.
Todd.
The selfing thing, but it kind of seems kind of along the same lines of the public morality versus the personal morality. Whereas, felt that he would have been really limited. He did accept the public faith, and no longer would have been a free expression of who he truly was. Because self and fame, if we see ourselves in fame, for ourselves in divine, in divinity, not so that we might boast ourselves over others, but rather just to accept ourselves, truly be who we truly are. It's much less limited in what we can do with ourselves.
Did everyone hear what Todd said?
No. I usually can't hear you.
You're going to have to shout over there. Shout to June and Laurie and Darren.
And also, if you can't hear it, what you need to do is to tell him you can't hear what he's saying, instead of being nice and polite. Be rude.
Right.
Christine gave us a marvelous example of being rude a couple times, I think.
Rude? A couple times? That's not rude. That's being assertive.
Anyway, Todd, can you repeat what you said shorter and louder?
Self and fame, to me, says that if we see ourselves in fame, it's not so it might be above others. Snooty about the whole thing, but rather it just gives us the power to see ourselves as truly ourselves, to accept us for what we are. We accept our personal morals rather than public morals, which gives us the power to truly be truly who we are. Not, and that takes away all the limitations of ourself, of the images.
And that's being self-empowered thing?
It's self-acceptance. I'd say it's more self-acceptance and going who you be rather than not self and fame. Oh, I'm beautiful.
Maybe what we ought to do is define what fame or being famous is. Anyone want to take a stab at it? I want to define what fame or being famous is.
There's a lot
of different kinds of fame. Okay, there isn't one kind of fame, but there probably is a context we can put it in the right.
Well, if we use Goldman and Narcissus as an example, Narcissus, his fame was as a highly respected,
abbot.
Yeah.
An ecclesiastical fame.
Uh-huh. And Goldman had his own kind of fame, though, too, because he's sort of famous for women. And I don't know, but it never really says that they've heard of him before or anything, so I don't really know.
Okay, well, so we said, go ahead.
I think that, are you trying to tap into the public? I mean, how the public makes people famous? I mean, public approval, that's how fame is started. Like, in a lot of ways, when I think of fame, what automatically comes to my head is what everybody approves of or what everybody likes. Everybody, meaning the general public.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're getting it.
Consensus.
Yeah.
Being well known. Being known by everybody.
Being well known. Okay.
Being in power.
Mine is close to that. I was thinking of having a particular strong trait.
An identity, you mean, sort of a particular strong
trait? Yeah, just something that's particularly strong about them. A great brain like Albert Einstein.
There's a lot of great brains around that that aren't famous, though.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people with strong personalities who aren't famous. Darren.
Or maybe somebody who has performed a heroic act or something like that that might not be like Albert Einstein or something. Like some child who helped another kid can become famous, get out of the river or something, can become famous in that town or even in national papers or something.
So what is it when he's famous in that town? What is it to be? I mean, so some guy saved somebody. A lot of people save a lot of people, and no one ever knows about them. What makes that one famous, even in that one town? Because recognition, everybody knows about it. Okay. So what fame is then is a kind of recognition. We all know that there are a lot of struggling musicians are an excellent example who run around doing the nightclub circuit, and at some point they become famous. They weren't famous before, although people knew who they were. At some point they become famous. That's an excellent example of what fame means. Fame means popularity, consensus, I think you said, acceptance, identity, all those sorts of things. Yes, Theo?
I would say that Ted Bundy is famous, but he wasn't accepted.
He was accepted for what he did. He wasn't accepted in what light. He was accepted as being an individual or an independent personage for what he did. Mm-hmm. And it was acceptance in that sense. Acceptance for, yeah, he was a killer.
What they call that is infamous. Infamous, but it's a kind of a notoriety without needing to have approval. But in our particular culture, I think that's a very interesting point you brought out, Theo, is that we make strange heroes out of people who are essentially going cross-purpose to our mind. Why is it that every time someone kills somebody, there's a serial murder going around, everyone's interested in who that person was? Books are published, films are made, all that sort of stuff. That happens. What is it about that makes that person infamous or famous? What is it then? What does it mean for us if many of us have fantasies of being famous? What does that mean? What is it that we're trying then to do by being famous?
Do we feel like we get some kind of control? We feel like we're on top of things, and at least we can control that the area that our expertise is known for.
Okay, so you become empowered through your fame, which means, if we accept the other identity, the other definition, we become empowered through the acceptance of others.
I think there are really two. I mean, more than two kinds, but there's some people who want to get famous, so they do anything they can to be known, and there are other people who are just doing their own thing, and then somehow someone sees it, and then it slowly comes out. Those are two really nice.
Okay, that's a very good point. There's also the people who do their own thing, become famous, and then somehow get lost in their fame. We've all seen that popular myth of someone who gets discovered, and suddenly they don't do any. Say they're an artist or a writer or a musician, and suddenly their work kind of deteriorates over time, or something happens. They become perverted through their fame, or something like that. Mother Teresa is famous. Mother Teresa doesn't do anything about it. She just probably doesn't even care about it. It's sort of somebody else's trip. Ronald Reagan is famous. That's a different kind of fame. But the point I'm trying to get about what it is what Kai said, essentially. That... You're not done, Kai. Go ahead.
Well, I think the same thing is there's one where the person is known because he's an identity, and sometimes he's known because of his mask.
So what is the model of fame that most of us have?
The ingrained Hollywood image or something into you, but...
Okay, let's say that, how does a person, let's become famous as they basically, you said, the mask. Okay, what's going to knock them dead? I know.
I'll try to kill the Pope.
Well,
playing into the public eye's emotion and playing into what they want, or being able to read the public and then knowing what you can do from there to take full advantage of that.
Living the myth.
Yep.
Yes.
Why can't you just be yourself and get there? I mean, you're talking about, it just frustrates me. I mean, you talk about how you're going to end up putting on a mask. Let's see, what can I do? I will do anything. I will be a fake. I'll spend all this bucks.
I think I saw Darren's hand go up first, and then I think Lisa is having to bite her lip. So
we talked about it, though, that there are different kinds. Some people are famous because of them being themselves, and they just happen to be seen for that. So I think that they're just going off with another type of fame than that.
rock stars though, and all those movie stars, are they really being themselves? And
maybe some of them are, but maybe some of them aren't. Or maybe some of them were at the beginning, but then because of their fame,
this is next.
Got corrupted in or whatever.
Chris and Meg after that, go ahead.
The question you asked Annette was, again, why can't you be yourself and get there? Why do you need to get there? Why is it important? That is what I'm asking myself again and again. Why do I need affirmation from other people outside me? Why can't I be happy inside myself?
I can answer that. I feel like, I know, at U of O, I was friends with a lot of musician students. And I think Gloria, as an artist, probably knows that if you choose a field that, well, like music or art or acting or anything, that usually they make famous people out of, that if you really want to live, eat bread and live in a house, you have to have some kind of success in it. And I know the success comes about from being yourself, or it can come about from living the myth. And I think there's two ways to go about it. And I don't know, I feel like if we just keep on track and think of two different things,
I think that there's also a lot of, I think you can be, there's fame for a whole society. You can be famous in a whole society. And, like, Annette, you're going into psych, right? I mean, you want to, one of the only ways you're ever going to make serious bucks is to be known.
Be good, be the best.
Dr. Morgan's new theory on child development. And I'm going into journalism, and the only way that I want to someday have you guys all pick up the time and go, whoa, Chris Ostrander, buy Chris Ostrander. And, but.
The book. Buy the movie.
but it's not, if it doesn't happen, as long as I'm being myself, I'm going to be famous with myself. I'm going to be popular with myself, and I'm going to feel good about myself, and I'll accept myself, and that's enough fame.
Meg.
This is a little off the subject, but I was sitting here listening to all this, and we're talking on big scale, you know, famous, mm-hmm. And I was making it more personal, like the battle everybody has with popularity, and a lot of what we say about famous people in the world relates to us or people we know just mm-hmm. at school.
Yeah.
Okay. And have you guys all
spoken about that? Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Meg. One thing I was going to try and say is, bring this back as a metaphor. If we're looking at what our society does with fame, and that you said, well, why can't we just be ourselves? Why can't people who are famous not have these masks? Why can't you, as a person relating to other people, not have masks? Why can't we all
That's
just be ourselves?
That's what I was trying
ourselves?
To hit on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is stealing.
Talk loud.
Stealing from whatever his name, the Board of Regents director who spoke at spring graduation, he said most of us live extraordinarily ordinary lives. Mm-hmm. And that's, it seems like, to be famous, we almost have to create something. Go, wow, about this or something. And, it does. Most of us are kind of ordinary folk. We're all, and it all comes down to basically the same. I don't know.
Well, I think you brought up a real good important issue about the ordinariness. I mean, mm-hmm. we think that's bad. And what happens is that if our lives happen to fit in a certain place, we can't validate ourselves for being who we are. No one else is who we are. There ain't nobody being me right now. And that's pretty neat. There ain't nobody being you. There ain't nobody being Chris. No one in the world can be Chris as good as Chris can be Chris. But we don't do that. We don't validate ourselves. And the thing is that most of the time, if we validate ourselves, who cares if the person on the other side of the world knows who we are? We're really happy, which is more than you can say for most of the people who are famous, in which case, hey, I'll trade any day for that. And it's the idea of having to be exceptional, that we all have that sense of needing to be exceptional, or settling for less. I mean, if there's a midlife crisis, it's that issue of, I guess I never really got that great job. I guess I really, really am not going to make that record. I'm not going to write that great book. I'm not going to be working on whatever it is. I'm not going to be singing in a great choir. Whatever it is. And then all we do is say, gosh, I didn't make it. rather than being able to say, I'm making it being who I am and valuing it. I went off on a side issue there.
There are also different kinds of fame. One person can be famous in a certain group of people and not be well known to other people.
Is that enough?
As being famous. And you may become notorious in your life in a certain way, and other people may never know about it, but you still have different degrees of affirmation or popularity from people. And you'll have to deal with that. I think that's what illusions is all about.
What does it mean also to be extraordinary? What's the other side of being extraordinary? But let's say we're talking about fame. Yeah, but I mean, if you are being extraordinary, you can be famous or you can be what? Okay, what? I imagine that if you were alive the day after Christ was crucified, you probably wouldn't have known anything about this really neat dude up there who was talking the word of God. You'd know about this guy who just sort of bled to death up there in the sky, like everybody else had for months and weeks and years before that. What I'm saying is that in order to be able to be extraordinary, in order to be able to live yourself to the greatest extent, you have to take the risk of being other than famous. I think Brent brought it up. If you're an artist and you're speaking about what it is, the art that you're doing, if you're doing it to be famous, you're going to be doing somebody else's art, and you probably won't be. If you're doing it to make a statement that no one else has heard, you have to risk starvation.
Amen.
And so the point being then that what is it when you are leading ordinary lives? You are not risking being who you are. And that's what Goldman did. Whether he became famous or not, he risked being who he was.
And that was enough.
It was enough for Goldman.
Just be famous.
What if your call is to be an ordinary person? Because you just said if you're not taking a risk, then you're not, you know, okay, if you're not taking a risk to be this extraordinary or whatever thing, then you're not being who you are. But what if to be your heart is to be, this is not, but to be the little old housewife that all she does is do the dishes and cook for the husband and has the little curlers in her hair? What if you've been called to do that? And maybe that's not being extraordinary, but maybe you're really happy.
That's being who you are. You can wear extraordinary curlers.
You could just be extraordinarily happy in what you're doing and give extraordinary amounts of love through the happiness that you have with the people that you touch base with. To say that my role is to be ordinary means that my role is to fit into somebody else's idea of what ordinary is. But if your goal is be whatever it is you are, then you are extraordinary in that process of being that. And it shows.
Extraordinary.
I think I've said this before, but I think my mother, who's a housewife, and I would not say that she's ordinary. I think in the society we're in, because that has been, women have been placed in that, stuck in that position for so long that we think that if they stay in that position, they're still stuck. The only way to be themselves would be to get out, which is true for some people, but it's not.
Let me elaborate a little bit. When I first came here, the hands are up, I'm not going to deny them. What happened here at Holton Village was an amazing kind of example of all that. Here, in this particular case, for me personally, I've met people that I probably wouldn't have talked to in any other walk of my life. And what's happened is I've met some people who, in their way, are extraordinary people. They're ordinary people, but they're extraordinary as people anyway. They do their job. They become extraordinary through the fact that they are doing their commitment at being who they are. And so how many times have we sort of accidentally bumped into somebody who you're on a bus or something, and you sort of fall into conversation simply because that you're so bored you don't know what else to do, and suddenly you say, this person is neat. This is a really amazing person. And how you carry that back with you, how your life is enriched, meeting Joe Ordinary next to you, who tells you a story of his part of the story of his life that just deeply affects you. I mean, what is that? That's being ordinary, but in a very extraordinary way. if it
was with Joe Ordinary, is that enough?
You have to ask Joe Ordinary about
Joe
it.
Joe Ordinary has to decide.
Carrie? Tom had it third. Well, okay.
Carrie, well, I just said it. I was just going to say that you, as a person, you're never just ordinary. Everyone is ordinary in their own special way. And then you're famous, I guess. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know.
I know what I mean, but I don't know. Let me think about it for a while.
Mm-hmm. I think what I have to say is this bothered me pretty close to what you're saying. It's what I was saying earlier, that nobody is better at being you than you, and nobody else can be you. And so I think being ordinary is a myth. I don't think you can be ordinary. You can think you're ordinary. But I mean, ordinary, what is that? Being like everyone else, but no one's the same, so how can you be ordinary? You have to accept that you're extraordinary just because you're brushing your teeth at 8:02 using your left hand and doing it in this motion. Nobody else is doing that then. I mean, everything you do is extraordinary because nobody else is doing it. And, you know, like, I'm going to be an engineer. How many famous, I mean, is there anybody who knows the name of a single engineer well, she knows Jerry, but...
Choo-choo Charlie.
Casey Johns.
Albert Schweitzer.
But it'll be extraordinary if I help draw the proper dimensions on a screw for a heart valve that save somebody's life or something. That person will never know me, but I've done an extraordinary thing in just doing one millionth of the work to help save that one life or something. And
that's a statement that you're making.
I mean, and that's not ordinary, and you can think you're ordinary, but I don't think you can be, and if you are, then you're pretty extraordinary at being ordinary.
I think it had her hand.
Is that okay?
Talk.
Well, this has been something that was my idea way back when, but it's kind of, you know, you're talking about, well, you need to decide who you are and be that person and be happy with it. But, like, for me, I know, okay, I've been spoiled, and there's a lot of nice things that I've been used to. And just being really honest, it scares me to think, and maybe I'm a little, I don't know, snobbish or whatever, if I don't get to be one of the real well-known shrinks or whatever out there, I'm not going to have that much to survive on. And, I mean, because, face it, without a graduate degree, at least, you don't make that much money at all, and it's really hard to find a job in accounting or whatever. And even with the master's, you're not going to make this buku bucks. But, and so then people try to tell me, yeah, but what if you're really helping these people? And that's what I really want to do. And if I can and spread the light to them, then that's great. But I still have this little thing about that I need to make a little bit of money to survive.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat, Annette. I'm in school trying to get my degree, and I teach to help bring in the money.
And I'm teaching, not working in my studio making art.
You might have to do something else to be able to do that thing that you need to do for yourself.
And if what you need is to make yourself comfortable, I mean, for right now, maybe that's what you also have to, that's the need you have to address, and you can sort of evolve into other ways of looking at it later. You know, I think you need to affirm whatever your needs are. But if what you say is, I'm going to be famous so I can really make a killing and be a millionaire and have 30 million houses and own...
I think you have to prioritize what your needs are and say, okay, I want to have a comfortable house, but I also want to contribute to people.
Isn't it more important to help those people, though?
That's a decision that you make yourself.
And there's nothing wrong with saying, right now, at this time, yeah, I want to help people, but yeah, I also want to make money. And like Lori said, it's an evolving process that I think that everybody goes through. I know I feel the same way.
It's not necessarily that you have to be in.
I mean, you'll come to a different point in your, maybe you'll come to a different point later on down the road where money won't be that important to you, but right now it is, and what's wrong, you can't deny that.
It's wrong for me to put so much precedence in it, though.
Why is that wrong? Because you feel that way? Because you're not supposed to feel that way?
It's selfish. selfish, it's wrong, it's not giving. And then I think that if eventually if you really think about it, and if you really decide that it's honestly selfish, and that it's not what you want, you know, I mean, it's going to be resolved.
You won't do it. I mean,
yeah, I know you can change,
but it's like a conflict.
Well, yeah.
Why can't we be consistent?
Conflict is...
Our heroes are always consistent.
Boring. You know? I mean, if you didn't ever have to decide anything at all, and if you never had to deal with anything, I mean, talk about shallow.
You can be in some countries where you are told what to do, what to work, where to live, when you can move, and who you live with.
Or you can be in the army.
What you're talking about is what do you have to give up?
Well, I'm willing to put in the hard work, shoot. And I mean, that's giving up something. But let's focus on others.
We're beginning to sort of slide off the issue a little bit. Brendan, you had your hand up?
It's not important.
Come up ahead, talk it.
What a martyr.
Say it anyway.
Oh, okay. Well, she's kind of struggling with it, and I feel like it's what you said before, that it's a risk to be yourself. And it's not going to be easy. Risking is not easy. It's not safe. It's not comfortable. It's not just saying, oh, this is the way it's planned out. My life is planned out. It's safe and secure and everything's going to be beautiful. You're saying, to be myself, it leaves me open for struggles and leaves me open for change. And to be risky and struggling.
I want to say one thing here, is that one of the things that we're doing here, ideally, is learning. And one of the things we forget about, I said this when the course first began, and I want to reiterate it, is how painful learning really is. Once we learn something, all we know is that we know it. We don't remember what it took to learn that thing. And whether it's playing the piano or riding the bicycle, the thing that I always talk about is we fell down a million times, or three or four times, we skinned our knees, we shed a little blood, we were humiliated, and before we finally sort of figured out how to be able to ride that bicycle. Knowing the self is the same kind of thing, in the sense that it's painful to learn. And as Brent says, if you are making the commitment to be yourself, it's going to cause you some degree of pain. It's going to cause you some anxiety. It's going to cause you confusion and conflict. And if you are the only one being you, it means you're probably not going to have support from some places in the process of figuring out who you are.
At the same time, not changing its role. Painful, too.
I just wanted to...
I think Tom had his hand first.
Sometimes there's more than one public morality, too. I mean, public morality says that you should be successful, that it's good to be making quite a bit of money, but it also says that you should be giving to the poor, that you should be giving yourself, and all this, and it's kind of, there's more than one public morality. I mean, I figured out mathematically, because I'm a mathematical person, that in order to be right with both of those, and obviously my biggest dream is to have a boat, have a really nice boat that I can take out sailing. That's going to be, $200,000. So in order to have that boat, feel good about myself and satisfy everybody, I'm going to have to make about $3 million a year, give all of it away except for maybe $60,000 or $70,000, and then, then I'm okay. But $3 million? Make a little screws for heart valves?
You might have to rent that boat.
Well, but then
you see how much it costs to rent a boat for a week.
Yeah, but there are ways.
Yeah, find a friend. There are.
Make friends. Marry into money.
There are other ways of looking at that problem, too, that maybe we don't need to discuss right now, but maybe we can discuss later. Was there another hand up over here? I thought, Christine, did you have your hand up? So be it. Maybe we'll come back. Does anyone else want to sort of raise a comment about that?
All I was just going to say was when Kate said, yeah, but it's also painful when you're not. What did you say?
When
you're not yourself.
When you don't change.
Yeah, I just wanted to be sure that got said. Because I mean, it is easier to go with it and not try to change or whatever. But then eventually you pay the price a lot heavier. I mean, it's painful right now, but.
bringing up that issue. Brent, it was on the syllabus. You probably would have forgotten all about it. And looking back on the syllabus issues that we hadn't quite gotten to, there are two issues from yesterday that we haven't really talked too much about. One of them is surrender versus control, and the other is sensual versus practical. Did we talk enough about surrender versus control?
No.
Okay. Yes.
I don't know if this has to do with that. It was a something I thought about, Narcissus and Goldman, that hasn't been mentioned yet. And it was back at the beginning. I found out, I had thought about it, I talked about my sister, and she read it, and something about it in her book. It was when Goldman was in the monastery, and he didn't feel right, but he didn't know, and all that needed to be said was for Narcissus to say, oh, well, you were ignoring your childhood. You know, and then, oh, and then overnight, he just changed. And I hadn't even really thought about that, but my sister, but she said how she had a little struggle with that in her life, and she feels like something isn't clicking, and that lots of people feel that way, and it really made her mad that it was so people. And she feels like there's got to be something that must click. And I hadn't even thought about that.
I think that's a real good point. Let me share personally about that. That I think that oftentimes Goldman goes through a lot of struggle, a lot of pain, a lot of self-denial before suddenly somebody says something that clicks in the book. And our lives sometimes are like that in the sense that we go through a lot of stuff, maybe years worth of stuff, and then one event happens and it like changes your life. In my particular life, it was when my first marriage fell apart. And I think that what happened to me in the process of doing that is I woke up. It was an amazingly cathartic experience one night, and maybe I can share that with you at another time. But what happened then is I started on a process then. It like changed, it turned a corner. And the first day I turned that corner, I might not even realize that the scenery had changed. And maybe the third day I got down there, and the fourth day I hadn't realized it. But looking back at it now from all these years, I realized that was the pivotal event. So in this particular book, what happens with Narcissus is Narcissus gives Goldman that pivotal event, which in the context of the myth, or the metaphor, he recognizes that as changing his life, and he leaves the monastery, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And our lives sometimes don't work as clearly as that because we don't live at the moment, and we are also stuck in it at the same time, so we can't always see that. But I think if you struggle with trying to find your own inner truth, and you are open to learning lessons from yourself and from others, that the struggle, it can happen in some ways that are much like that, but it may take years, it may take decades. I mean, I know people who were 55 years old before suddenly a great realization about their lives came to them, and bang, oh, they changed completely some very important parts of their lives, and we're very happy to have made that change.
The women call that the click. In some of the realizations that they have about their role in society. One woman who was a journalist wrote an article about how she was Catholic and married and had kids, and then all of a sudden things fell apart for her, and somebody said something at a speech, and then in parentheses it went click. Something hit her. It was that aha moment, but it took her all her lifetime to build up to that specific second.
Psychologists call that the moment of gestalt. The whole picture, one big bang. The parts were there, you knew all the information before, but for some reason, suddenly they fit together in some kind of a way. It's a struggle to get there.
Maybe more than one.
Where is this woman from? Is she a acquaintance?
She all of a sudden turned into a feminist. She'd been a housewife, she'd been a mother, she'd been a nice, sweet young thing all her life, and somebody said something about what women were, and she read underneath, she read the underlying meaning, and she saw this whole system that was set up against her, and she became radicalized, and she started writing for Ms. Magazine, and in the movement, they call it the click.
Okay, couldn't figure out, you said women, or the women call it the click.
Sorry.
Who the women were.
Sometimes I speak in cryptic fog.
Okay.
back to narcissism and goals. Is that okay? Is that, did we finish that? Does anyone else have anything to say about that, that issue?
I guess I could see something into that too, that the way, even if he realizes that, even if we're looking at our childhood, that I see the struggle still, that we can't just, in a way, somehow his life was to go out and wander around, and so he didn't need anything. Maybe that's a metaphor for the way we can wander, but he could walk out the door because he knew that was to do, and there was no preparation for it, and it was a big risk. You kind of went, how can he leave this? But for us, who there are goals that aren't wandering around and, you know, sleeping in the snow, that... that how could I think that maybe there's a problem of relating his wandering to what how our wandering can be in the society.
Or do you mean it could be mental wandering as well as physical?
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, see that we can all just kind of go out and everything's gonna, I don't know.
It's kind of fun for some of you in the sense to have a nice upbringing and then all of a sudden go on a field trip or all of a sudden go and youth hostel through Europe. It's a tremendously freeing time and you see different aspects of yourself. So this wandering can be many different kinds of wandering. It can be wandering in your mind, but it can also be wandering during the summer or wandering during an interim.
And like Jeff described, what happened to him is he wandered to the Far East, and it took him years before it really kind of percolated through and affected him too. So, yeah.
So it doesn't have to be an instant click. I mean, is that, because that's what I think about too when you think about like some Christian religions or Pentecostals, you know, being baptized in the Spirit, all of a sudden, bang, after that, it's all the same. Is there room for gradual change? I mean, that there has to be a click to life in the first one. I like to kind of feel left out.
You're not trying hard enough to let go.
Yeah, I think that, like, Kate just whispered to me that ties into surrender. And I think what happens when you get the click is that you give up one framework of experiencing the world and understanding it and allow another framework to appear to you. It's a kind of surrender in the sense that that change happens when you're willing to look at it from another perspective. But you're right. It doesn't always have to be a quick. It can be a gradual thing. And too often times we expect life to change so radically. It's sort of like the idea of marriage is that, okay, we go through this romantic place, we get married, and we expect life is going to be bliss after that. It's not. And the one of the problems with all that is that we always expect these changes, and then, okay, we experience the change, we're done, now what happens with the rest of my life? I guess it's over. And so life is a series of gradual shifts for many of us. Lisa?
All I was going to say is I could really hear you on that, just because I've always felt like that, like when is my major insight going to come, you know? And I've gotten to the point where I feel like, for me at least, there's little aha. You don't need this long way. I mean, it's like for me, it's become more of a journey. And instead of, I keep on thinking, okay, this is it, man. My life is going to change now. And it's like, you know. And they're more like little baby ahas instead of a big parent one.
I want to get back to, this is really relevant to Goldman and his wanderings, which we were talking about before. Does Goldman come to any great realizations as going on his wanderings?
What did you say? Sorry.
Does Goldman come on to any great realizations as he's going about his wanderings?
What about learning the different faces of expressions and how they all tie into the same one? I mean, that seemed something important to him, and he kept on putting it in his mind.
Yeah, but was it a great gestalt? Was it a great click?
I think it was a culmination of a lot of little things. Like looking at all the faces and then gathering them up and looking at them together.
Like maybe it was a combination of a bunch of little clicks, but it was sparked by maybe a bigger click, which made it seem like
What were the big clicks?
Thanks, Darren, for clarifying that.
What were the big clicks?
Like when he looked at the Madonna in the thing, then he realized all the facial expressions, but it had been his past experience with all the other, seeing the agony of the lady giving birth and all the other faces and stuff.
Okay, you said an important word. What was it then that led up to that? Was past experience. Okay. What am I getting at when I say that?
They have a metaphorical meaning of past experiences.
To get to the point where you can sort of click, if you will, or experience the world differently or learn something about it, you need to build up a reservoir of experiences that you have that can then at some point be shuffled together in a new way. Okay. I was having this discussion, I think, with Lori earlier. Now let me tie this all up now with another vision of somebody else's morality. What is it about somebody else's morality that might keep that from happening? Want to elaborate that?
Their experience. I felt like we were discussing like morality that one day, we're talking about religion that one day, we really didn't start understanding one another until we started sharing our own stories, kind of, our own where we were, our experiences and things. I guess maybe that's where we face a lot of our learning or our insights and ahas on our own personal experiences, which is different than everybody else.
That's part of what I'm saying. What I think sometimes happens, the issue I'm trying to get at, and how Goldman manifested so wonderfully as opposed to Narcissus, both different ways of doing it, is that how can anybody develop a system of experiencing the world unless it's based on experience? What happens if you have imposed upon you from someone else or from yourself a method that keeps you from having experiences, keeps you from being open to whatever the experience is? I'm not saying that you have to go out and do what Goldman did, but Narcissus did that as well. He was open to experience, including the experience of Goldman, which was out of his context. So experience is the most important part of it. The people I know who finally have that major awakening later on in lives always talk about how I was asleep for 15 years. Where was I during that time? What was it all about? Why couldn't I see what was going on? Because they weren't experiencing. They were busy living somebody else's kind of system. They weren't looking at what they were doing. And so the message for me about Goldman and the book in general is that no matter what your value system is, it has to be yours. You have to develop experiences to make them yours. And you have to maintain an openness in order to have those experiences. That's sort of the hierarchy, if you will, of that process. And the click happens, I think, when you've got that reservoir.
And the fact that it's the faces, I think that's really interesting. Use that in the book.
Why don't you elaborate?
The different faces, the different people, the different identities come together.
What Lori said about that Narcissus did the same thing. We were talking about control last night, and we had labeled that Narcissus needed this control and Goldman kind of didn't. But we kind of agreed that both of them had control, or both of them hadn't fallen into the control of the society because they had made the choice of what they were going to do. And it wasn't, it's the choice. You might be doing the same thing, but if you're doing it because it's your choice, then they don't have control.
On that same token, how did Narcissus surrender? We can see in a way how Goldman surrendered, but how did Narcissus surrender?
Giving up the friendship?
Giving up the friendship was certainly a real important part of it, you know.
By accepting, I guess I see he surrendered because he accepted that he was supposed to have control. He accepted, and I see that as how he surrendered. He didn't fight against it.
To me, it didn't hit me that he ever really did surrender until the very last page of the book, in the Goldman book, and that's where. So, don't mean to ruin the ending, give light to the end, but that's what I think the surrender to Narcissus.
Lisa?
I don't know, part of me agrees with Chris about how he accepted his own fate and he accepted Goldman's fate as two separate things, and he was able to let it be at that. But another part of me thinks he never really did surrender, and maybe I'm totally wrong, but I'm asking you. I mean, I don't know. I want you to tell me.
I want you to tell me. Elaborate.
I don't want to tell you. I want you to tell me. I don't know what I think.
Well, you feel that somehow he didn't quite surrender.
I feel like he got the shaft. I feel like Goldman is one who experienced life, and he had a hard time, but he made it, and he died knowing that he did what he needed to do for himself. Whereas I feel like Narcissus just didn't, I mean, he was stagnant.
Thanks for the answer.
Okay, Tom. He
wasn't told to the ending.
I think maybe Narcissus had his click and his surrender before the book started. Coming into it, he seemed to have everything worked out for himself before anything ever started. So maybe he had already had things.
I thought that too, except until I got close to the end of the book, and then when you get to the end, I'm not going to say what happens, but you'll understand.
Okay.
Maybe this, because I haven't read the whole book, okay. Yeah, I have 90 more pages to go. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is, I just have a question. Does a person, in order to supposedly not miss out, supposedly experience or find that click, do they have to go out and totally experience, you know, like Goldman is? Can't they, all of a sudden he got this, maybe it was from God, maybe it was from his past, but maybe it was just him, it was not his mother or anybody else telling him. But it was really him to be a monk, and to be the best that he could be at being a monk, and be the most dedicated. And maybe he really wasn't missing out. Maybe some of us who want to be more free of the, say, hey, honey, you're missing out on the good life. But to him, that is the good life.
That's the question that I'm asking you, and I guess we can't discuss it until everybody finishes the book. But I want to understand the ending.
Well, we don't have to talk about the ending, but we can talk about what Annette was talking about.
Yeah.
And I think that therein lies the dilemma of the whole process of figuring out what your image is, because nobody can tell you. There is no answer. You have to discover your own answer. And whatever that is to you is what it is. And it could be in a monastery, it can be having a nice home and raising a family, it can be going out and being a rock musician, it can be doing whatever.
You have to discover your own mode of surrender, is that what you're saying?
Yes, and that's one of the things I wanted to get back to in terms of Narcissus, is that I agree with what Chris said, is that in a certain context, he never surrendered the idea of, in a way, he had control, but he did surrender in terms of identifying who he was, especially as it related to Goldman. He knew, in his heart, of hearts, he knew who he was. He knew what he had to do, and so he did it. He also recognized that there was pain involved in that choice. But by knowing it and doing his job, he fulfilled himself. And in the process of fulfilling himself, he still had something to share and gain from Goldman many, many years down the line. Yeah.
So he did fulfill himself. Because I don't understand the end then. Why does, I don't, maybe I have to talk about
it. We'll talk about that tomorrow, so we can also talk about it. Kai?
Yeah, you said something about experience. You have to experience your own experience and not other people's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I don't know how, if I understand that pretty well. I mean, I think that the experiences I experienced are not my own. And then I don't know, I mean, so I guess I'm the one to judge. But I don't see, if it's your choice that you make, how are you living somebody else's experience?
Right, if it's your choice that you make, probably not.
Is it a conscious choice?
Sure.
Goldman says, I don't know Narcissus, but in overcoming life and resisting despair, you thinkers and theologians seem to succeed better. I have long since stopped envying you for your learning, dear friend, but I do envy your calm, your detachment, your peace. And then Narcissus says, you should not envy me, Goldman. There is no peace of the sort you imagine. Oh, there is peace, of course, but not anything that lives within us constantly and never leaves us. There's only the peace that must be won again and again each new day of our life. You don't see me fight. You don't know my struggles as happened. My struggles in the prayer show. I thought that was kind of what we were talking about. That he, in a way, he looks better. Narcissus looks like his life is easier the way that he did it. And even Goldman thinks that, that he went out and lived himself as he is and Narcissus didn't.
When I heard that, one night was in Vespers, the peace of God is no peace.
Yeah, I think that's a real excellent point. One of the things I think that the book talks about, and one of the things that I think the course talks about, if it's successful, is that there is no peace even after you think you found out who you are and what it's about. That you are constantly changing by gathering new experiences, and it's a reevaluation that happens in a daily way. And sometimes you realize you've made some mistakes, or sometimes you think you've made some mistakes. And the only way to resolve the problem is to continue the journey. So many of us tend to get to a point of realization and stop journeying. Brent's gone, but one of the things he was talking about earlier is that when, in a conversation several of us were having, was how when he found himself in God, he sort of was in a time in life of getting a lot of really neat dreams, and then now the dreams sort of aren't there anymore. To me, what that means is there was a point in time when he was open to his experiences and was able to understand and accept, and then he put them into a nice little architecture. That's what we all do. But what happens with that architecture is it makes sense out of the world, but it also makes us comfortable. It builds a nice little wall around us, and we can light our nice wood stove and read all of our books and have a good time, but it also shields us from other experiences. And so our life is a constant struggle with in reaching plateaus of acceptance and then building up to a new level of acceptance and sort of taking up those other stairs. Goldman does that. Goldman does it in a free-flowing kind of way without needing an end result. In fact, he doesn't even know that he's going to wind up back in the monastery until much later on in the book, when suddenly he realizes that Abbot Daniel is still haunting him, and that it was time to meet Narcissus, and then he was ultimately saved by Narcissus. And one other point. I'm getting off the subject. I talked about him a little bit.
Find out.
You'll
hear about it.
So I think that one of the things for this particular book that was so powerful to me is I realized that life isn't finding the answers and then living the answers. Life is a process of developing a system that is constantly being composted and new systems developed from it. In fact, I often think that the whole idea of a system is an invention just to sort of keep us relatively sane and give us something to talk about to each other. That there probably isn't any real system. We are, Kate's sending me notes here, she has doubts underlined, that we always have doubts. Even though we're convinced about something being right, I have never not experienced some doubt about it, some feeling that, am I a jerk? Did I say that right? Do I really know what I'm talking about anyway? Do I really want to be a teacher? Maybe I would like to do something else. I mean, no one ever told me when I was growing up that, yeah, you're never really going to know what you're going to want to do on some level. No one ever told me that. Everyone always told me that, yeah, you go out there and you can be happy and you raise a family and you get a nice job and then all life's grand and then you can go on vacations
and it's safe
and comfortable and hunky-dory. Yes, Kai?
The thing that we read in our last semester in ISP, I think it was, was it Montaigne or was Dustin? I think who used this doubt thing completely. He used skepticism as his way of learning. He cut everything down so there was absolutely nothing. And he started building things up, and I think that skepticism has to be such a part of our learning first. That first people say, well, you have to do this, and then don't even believe it. First you doubt it, and then you think about it, and just
challenge your assumptions.
Which, of course, can make you into a crazy man at times. I mean, I think we all had that point. Me, nothing is absolute. Everything is subject to question. I remember when I was in high school, I suddenly realized mathematics is arbitrary.
Mathematics is science is arbitrary? Good God. What is the world made out of? I mean, eventually you kind of settle down and you realize, well, it really probably doesn't make much difference if it sort of makes sense. But I think that's what we have to do with all the systems we have. If they make you comfortable, experience your comfort, but realize that it is all personal. Did you feel that when you found out that mathematics was an arbitrary thing?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I had one class last semester where we started off with nothing, and then we started off with the numbers 1 through 10, I mean, or 1 through 0 through 9, and then we just went from there all the way to a place where we could take an integral that was impossible to take in the normal way, project it onto a complex plane, take a loop integral around it, take a Laplace transform and come back to it and find the answer. And it's just kind of like, yeah, I mean, it was just all, we did invent everything as we went along, and we just, for convenience sake, we gave it the same names that the mathematicians did who invented it the first time.
So that was a yes?
Yes.
I think.
Plus one.
I think I'm kind of sometimes in the same frame of mind as Tom, because I think of myself sometimes still as a math major. And it doesn't really matter, I'm not. But I think when I realized that things were arbitrary was a concept in a book I read by Robert Heinlein, science fiction, where the scientist was studying the fourth dimension, and I don't know, I just discovered this, but what was said in the book was it wasn't there something to decide, but everything that the people thought of it, like if he decided that the fourth dimension should be purple, it was purple. That there weren't rules to begin with, but we put rules on it, and those rules became the rules. We defined it, and that what became the definition.
I remember reading a story once that was very much like that, and what it was a personification of God sort of sitting up there trying to say, you know, there's got to be always a mystery in life, otherwise there's really going to be no point in living. And so every time somebody would discover something, he would invent a process that would go along with that discovery just to keep the mystery going. And in the story, God sitting up there saying, in this case it was a he God, because this was an old story, but he's sort of saying, gosh, they invented the microscope. Now I'm just going to have to go ahead and make cells and make molecules. Boy, these guys just never quit. And it's sort of part of that same idea that our reality is a projection, whether it's a divine projection or a personal projection, but it is a projection.
It makes interesting. What would be different kind of difference? Like if we did math differently.
I was just going to say that you said about he God. I thought it was kind of interesting here. You talked about Mother God.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we still have time to try and move back to the idea of surrender and control as it relates to our lives. Maybe, having read most of the book and having heard this conversation, somebody can give, sort of distill, maybe some ideas of what this sort of issue is that is described by these two words. Anybody want to take a stab at it? Go ahead, Annette.
Surrendering, knowing. Letting yourself forget about maybe those things that have been said that you got to follow and all that. And surrender to that, and surrender to yourself and who yourself really is and wants to be.
Okay. What do you think about that? Is that a good way?
How do you do it? You just say, okay, I'm not going to think about it. You can't do that.
So what do you have in order to be able to do that?
Time.
Okay, maybe. Maybe. Okay, open. What else?
The two are inseparable. I mean, you surrender a control to get a different control, and then you surrender that to get a different control. And I think it's just a continual process of you're surrendering control to get some higher control.
I'm
I'll
take it. Yeah.
Please,
you know, you have control to surrender.
Your own control?
I mean, can, if you surrender, that means you're in control of the surrender.
Well, no, it means you're making a choice. But I don't know if you to surrender, you give up control.
But
you have to have control to make the decision.
I think Yoda did have control. Because, like, whenever he'd come, he'd have to make a decision over and over again to be surrendering himself. Like when he came to the knight's place, he was struggling with it. And he was in control when he finally poisoned her, you know, I don't know. And also when he decided to leave the ark, you know. When he decided to keep walking from town to town, I think in a way he was controlling himself in a different way.
Christine.
It seems to me like surrender is what you do when you don't have any other choice, because you don't usually surrender, like I'm thinking, like in war and stuff, until there's nothing left that you can do. So it's not like you have to make this, you know, you have to think so hard about it. It's like, this is all I can do anymore.
I give up.
Or you surrender to the better option instead of not surrendering. Seeing the control has lost so much.
You said something right there. Yeah. You said surrender to the better option.
Yeah.
What does that imply when you say surrender to the better option?
That control isn't right.
No.
That
what that implies is
changing.
No. But you are still in control. Because if you recognize that there is an option, you still are in control of thinking about what those options are. Surrender is surrendering, period. And what do we call that? What is another word for that kind of thing? What do you have to have before you can surrender with no understanding of how far the bottom is away when you jump off that cliff? Now, risking is what you do. Trust is one word.
Faith.
That's what both Narcissus and Goldman had that we talked about before, and that's what the issue of surrender is about. A lot of people, when they get to that point in their lives, when they sort of are desperately trying to make things make sense, elect certain people to office, be sure that certain things are stated in the right way, make sure certain books aren't read, only listen to certain kinds of music, are demonstrating their lack of faith. So if surrender is a manifestation of faith, what is control?
Control is having faith.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that, David?
Well, if you have control over a situation, it means that it makes sense to you.
Keep talking.
And then? David can talk if he wants to.
Fear to let go and have faith is control. Because you said that surrender is a manifestation of faith. You have faith that you can surrender. But the control is, you're scared. You have this fear. And you don't have the faith. And so you want to be on top and have the control. And that way you think then that you...
Not just fear of control is having, fear of surrender is having control, but even wanting to surrender is having control.
Wanting to surrender
is having control.
I mean, you're saying it just happens, you don't want, there's no desire. I mean, there's no, I know what
you're saying. Yeah, you can't surrender today. I mean, maybe you will, but it's not something you can do, it's something you have.
I think you can make a choice to surrender, but I think if you make a choice to surrender because you think it's going to with expectations, then you're not surrendering. The thing about surrender is that you have no expectations. You don't say, I'm going to get enlightenment. You don't say, I'm going to die. You don't say, I'm going to be fed. You don't have any expectations. Surrender is, gee, I wonder what will happen. Tom.
I know there is some profound metaphor for this in all Goldman's wandering right after he killed Victor, where he was just the fear of death or whatever was driving him along. There's some profound metaphor in there with somebody. He's funny what it is. I mean,
okay, let's refresh our memory what happens. He meets up with Victor, And Victor is sort of this interesting guy to him, but he's also kind of a creep. And he tries to steal his gold coin. And in protection of himself, Narcissus, Goldman accidentally, or he's put in the position where he has to kill Victor in order to preserve himself. And then what happens to Goldman after that? Someone sort of tell me the scenario.
He just goes crazy and he starts wandering around and he'll stop, he'll think he wants to die, but something will keep him driving along, keep driving, driving, driving. He doesn't know what's driving him along. Something is just doing it.
And then what happens? What goes on after that?
Finally, he ends up at the town and he's saved. But
he confesses, he gives up his faith.
Well, what happens after that? After that?
Well, later on, when he was facing the plague, he said that he had given up his death during that time, and he didn't the plague in spirit because he already
accepted
death, and so he was not going to get on. I don't think he's dead. Maybe he can have to run away in the bar.
Christine, and then Christine. Oh, you don't even have to.
I was curious, why did Hesed, you said that Hesed put everything in there for a reason, why did he put in the reason that when he went back, as the girl laughed at him and showed him the gold coin, and he didn't have the gold coin, and he took it.
He did.
She had taken care of him.
When he was kind of delirious and everything.
And she had the coin and was holding it for him.
Keeping it for him.
Oh, and then when she went back to him, she gave it to him.
She's kind of like a silly man leaving a loose coin in your pocket. You should know better. Keep it sewn up in this little hidden pocket that I have for you.
What did he do in his delirium at that one particular point? Just sort of give you a little small thing before you get back to that other general one. Is he had to surrender. He sort of just had to say, oh, I can't do anything. And what happens? He didn't lose anything. In the one struggle, he murders somebody as a way of protecting what he thought was his, since he didn't want to lose it, his life, his gold. Another case, he isn't even capable of protecting himself. He surrenders to the moment, and what happens is he's taken care of. I think those are two, not to say that you surrender at every moment or you protect yourself at every moment, but those are two sort of things that are balancing here, that are part of the general metaphor. Carrie, do you have your hand up?
No.
Okay, let's sort of relook at this now. He has that point where he kills somebody. He really is upset about it. He doesn't know what it is. He almost wants to die himself. He wanders around. He experiences a kind of act of confession, which helps to a degree, but there's that other event that finally happens. He creates death at one point. Yes, Chris?
When, I don't remember, is it when he sees Madonna? Is that when he sees Madonna and realizes, recognizes his purpose? No.
I don't think
I saw a new goal.
Maybe I'm getting the sequence wrong. He experiences the black plague before he decides before he returns. Isn't that what happens?
Yeah.
He leaves the apprenticeship. He goes off and experiences the black plague, and
right.
Then he sort of comes back.
Sorry. Okay.
Okay. No. That's so. He confesses. He sees the Madonna. He finds his goal. He thinks his goal at the time. He moves into the town. He apprentices himself in a strange sort of way. He proves his great artistic merit, and then he abandons ship, still feeling that kind of lost experience. And then he experiences the Black Plague and that other woman. Seems to me that, rather than tell you what it seems to me, what does that sound like is happening throughout these experiences? What is Goldman creating for himself in these experiences? Goldman is creating for himself a series of metaphorical deaths. He approaches something, he commits suicide in a sense by denying it, moving on. He takes something and he keeps doing that. And then what happens is he moves into the bubonic plague part of this book. He helps this one person experience death unselfishly. And then he suddenly realizes he has to go back. First he goes back to the master that doesn't exist, and then he realizes ultimately that he has to go back to the monastery, even though he is saved from death by Narcissus. He talks about it in that one section about maybe it's time to go back. And then he tries to sort of have one last fling, and the one last fling kind of puts him into that other dependent position. And how he was capable then, what was he capable of doing at that one moment in the jail? He was capable of repeating what had happened that one time with Victor. You're right. I think that's a rather significance in the way the book is structured. He murders once, and it causes him great consternation. He's in the process of getting ready to murder again, and this time he's saved from it by his friend. I think we can talk more about that, too, once the book is over, because I think it has a lot to do with the very end of the book. Yes, Kate?
If you're done with Victor's thing, I'm still bad. My mind's back here on the surrender thing. I guess it's something that's bothering me. To me, it makes sense. The surrender is having no expectations. That, and the way I think, it seems like we're being suggested, it's looking like, take a risk. Surrender, it's going to hurt. Maybe you're going to have some bad experiences. Maybe this is going to work. But in the end, you're going to be closer to yourself. You're going to be better for it. And if we're looking at that positive after the hurt of the surrendering, isn't that having expectations of it?
Is it?
Do you really want the positive after it?
I think that's what I'm doing. That's why, I don't know, I feel like that's what they're saying so much. Take the risk, surrender, that you can't do it because, I just...
You aren't really surrendering then, though, if you think that there's something positive, because if you are really surrendering, you don't know. It could be something bad.
Right, but the way it sounds like they're saying is Lori, to me, is saying, surrender, this is the whole thing about becoming yourself better, knowing yourself better. To me, if you know yourself better, that's better for yourself. So, in a sense, there's a positive thing for it. That's how my mind picks it out. And in a way, that's an expectation. Maybe that's what's stopping me from being able to surrender. But that's what, between the expectations and what I hear, is the
conflict. Does anyone have a response to that?
Expectations, or just seems like you're creating these expectations. It's just not something that we can set and define now. The definition is going to come in time. And Lori and Kate have a few years up on us, but they might realize this better than we can sit here and formulate it in our own mind. We should accept that. It does come in time, whatever it is, maybe happiness or expectations.
Let me metaphorically give an answer.
How appropriate.
When I go into my studio and I sit down saying that either sometimes I just feel an urge to work, or sometimes I think, gee, I've got a show coming up, I've got to get some art done. The style I work is the kind of surrender that that I talk about when I talk to Kai. If there's a part of me that always goes into the studio thinking that I've lost this. I really can't do any more art. I'm really not going to be able to do it any good. I don't have any inspiration. It was all an accident that I was able to create anything in the first place. And what I have to do then is surrender myself to the process of what art is. What I mean by that is I have to say, I may not make another piece of art in my life. Or I may make a masterpiece. Or I may do something in the middle I don't know, and I really can't care. I turn on my television, because I have a nice television there in my studio, and I let my conscious mind watch an old movie. If I'm lucky, it's got Humphrey Bogart. And so there it is, off there going, and my pencil is in my hand, and my pencil starts to doodle. I don't say I'm going to draw anything, I don't know that I'm going to draw anything, and oftentimes I don't do anything but just listen to the television set. But sometimes when I'm not there, when the conscious mind isn't there, when I've surrendered myself to the idea of just the process of drawing and not worrying about making a piece of art, something comes out magically in that process. And then I can refine it. Then I can take control. But I must surrender first. And in terms of what it is, in terms of surrender, is the reason I say that, yeah, the only way you're going to have a life that may have value to you is through surrender, is I don't think we have a choice. I look at all the people who live their lives tightly controlling their lives, and I don't think that that's a life I want to lead. And certainly I see that it's a life that even they struggle with being happy with leading. But one of the things that's important about it is to sort of say, yeah, I don't know if I have a vision for what the future is. I don't even know if this is going to hurt or not. I'd rather it not hurt. I mean, I don't purposefully want to see myself hurt. But you must surrender even the idea of learning a lesson from it. Because the important thing about it is that you never know what your lessons are in advance. You can't know that. And so consequently, by trying to have a vision of what it is you need to learn, you're going to miss all the neat stuff that's out there to learn from. And what Goldman does, I think, that is of value at first, is that he says, I've got to lead this life, and I don't know what's going to happen to me, but it's going to happen, and that's the part. It's going to happen. Not that I'm going to do this, just that it's going to happen. That doesn't serve him all the way through. Eventually, he gets to the point where he says, no, now it's time to return. But the important part of that surrendering aspect is surrendering your vision of what the idea of surrender is as well. Darren.
Relating back to the book, Goldman did the same thing you did, kind of, when he was drawing the picture to get the apprenticeship or to of the master or whatever. He surrendered to this idea of Narcissus, and then he just kind of drew it, and he wasn't really thinking about it.
In my degree program, I have a very clear experiment that I'm doing, and then I get into it, and my prof says, well, how is the status supposed to look? And I thought I had a clear idea, and then I have to redefine how it's supposed to look on this computer screen or with this system. And then he'll say, well, how are you going to analyze it? And then I keep asking myself, oh my God, if I don't know how it's supposed to look and I don't know how to analyze it and I don't know what's going to come after that, how am I ever supposed to write my chapter 4? And it's on draft, but it's not perfect and I'll never get there. And finally what he told me was, just do one thing at a time. And that was a really good message for me, to know that I had enough in myself to be able to handle each thing that came along in its own time, and I couldn't force it. And I couldn't say, I've got to get that chapter 4 done by February 14th, 1986, or I'm going to die. Because if I felt that way,
I'd be dead
by now. Because chapter 4 ain't done. And so what I have to do is keep surrendering, in a sense, to figuring out how it is flowing. And it is going to flow, and it's going to come out, and it's going to be totally different from what I expected. And I think that's what some of you experienced when you were working on your shrines, and also when you're working on your inner outer, and also when you're doing free rites. And sometimes that's a very positive experience, and other times it's very frustrating, and you feel stuck and you get frustrated.